that everyone can and should enjoy. If someone fell below the norm, it was the job of doctors to fix the problem and help him or her be like everyone. In contrast, upgrading the healthy is an elitist project, because it rejects the idea of a universal standard applicable to all, and seeks to give some individuals an edge over others. People want superior memories, above-average intelligence, and first-class sexual abilities. If some form of upgrade becomes so cheap and common that everyone enjoys it, it will simply be considered the new baseline, which the next generation of treatments will strive to surpass. Second, 20th century medicine benefited the masses because the 20th century was the age of the masses. 20th century armies needed millions of healthy soldiers, and the economy needed millions of healthy workers. Consequently, states established public health services to ensure the health and vigor of everyone. Our greatest medical achievements were the provision of mass hygiene facilities, the campaigns of mass vaccinations, and the overcoming of mass epidemics. The Japanese elite in 1914 had a vested interest in vaccinating the poor and building hospitals and sewage systems in the slums, because if they wanted Japan to be a strong nation with a strong army and a strong economy, they needed many millions of healthy soldiers and workers. But the age of the masses may be over, and with it the age of mass medicine. As human soldiers and workers give way to algorithms, at least some elites may conclude that there is no point in providing improved or even standard conditions of health for masses of useless poor people, and it is far more sensible to focus on upgrading a handful of superhumans beyond the norm. Already today, the birth rate is falling in technologically advanced countries such as Japan and South Korea, where prodigious efforts are invested in the upbringing and education of fewer and fewer children, from whom more and more is expected. How could huge developing countries like India, Brazil, or Nigeria hope to compete with Japan? These countries resemble a long train. The elites in the first-class carriages enjoy healthcare, education, and income levels on a par with the most developed nations in the world. However, the hundreds of millions of ordinary citizens who crowd the third-class carriages still suffer from widespread diseases, ignorance, and poverty. What would the Indian, Brazilian, or Nigerian elites prefer to do in the coming century? Invest in fixing the problems of hundreds of millions of poor, or in upgrading a few million rich? Unlike in the 20th century, when the elite had a stake in fixing the problems of the poor because they were militarily and economically vital, in the 21st century, the most efficient, albeit ruthless, strategy may be to let go of the useless third-class carriages and dash forward with the first class only. In order to compete with Japan, Brazil might need a handful of upgraded superhumans far more than millions of healthy, ordinary workers. How can liberal beliefs survive the appearance of superhumans with exceptional physical, emotional, and intellectual abilities? What will happen if it turns out that such superhumans have fundamentally different experiences to normal sapiens? What if superhumans are bored by novels about the experiences of lowly sapiens thieves, whereas run-of-the-mill humans find soap operas about superhuman love affairs unintelligible? The great human project of the 20th century, overcoming famine, plague, and war, aimed to safeguard a universal norm of abundance, health, and peace for all people without exception. The new projects of the 21st century, gaining immortality, bliss, and divinity, also hope to serve the whole of humankind. However, because these projects aim at surpassing rather than safeguarding the norm, they may well result in the creation of a new superhuman caste that will abandon its liberal roots and treat normal humans no better than 19th century Europeans treated Africans. If scientific discoveries and technological developments split humankind into a mass of useless humans and a small elite of upgraded superhumans, or if authority shifts altogether away from human beings into the hands of highly intelligent algorithms, then liberalism will collapse. What new religions or ideologies might fill the resulting vacuum, and guide the subsequent evolution of our godlike descendants. Chapter 10. The Ocean of Consciousness. The new religions are unlikely to emerge from the caves of Afghanistan or from the madrasas of the Middle East. Rather, they will emerge from research laboratories. Just as socialism took over the world by promising salvation through steam and electricity, so in the coming decades new techno-religions may conquer the world by promising salvation through algorithms and genes. Despite all the talk of radical Islam and Christian fundamentalism, the most interesting place in the world from a religious perspective is not the Islamic State or the Bible Belt, but Silicon Valley. That's where high-tech gurus are brewing for us brave new religions that have little to do with God and everything to do with technology. They promise all the old prizes, happiness, peace, prosperity, and even eternal life. But here on Earth, with the help of technology, rather than after death with the help of celestial beings. These new techno-religions can be divided into two main types, techno-humanism and data religion. Data religion argues that humans have completed their cosmic task, and they should now pass the torch on to entirely new kinds of entities. We will discuss the dreams and nightmares of data religion in the next chapter. This chapter is dedicated to the more conservative creed of techno-humanism, which still sees humans as the apex of creation and clings to many traditional humanist values. Techno-humanism agrees that Homo sapiens, as we know it, has run its historical course and will no longer be relevant in the future, but concludes that we should therefore use technology in order to create Homo Deus, a much superior human model. Homo Deus will retain some essential human features, but will also enjoy upgraded physical and mental abilities that will enable it to hold its own even against the most sophisticated non-conscious algorithms. Since intelligence is decoupling from consciousness, and since non-conscious intelligence is developing at breakneck speed, humans must actively upgrade their minds if they want to stay in the game. 70,000 years ago, the cognitive revolution transformed the sapiens mind, thereby turning an insignificant African ape into the ruler of the world. The improved sapiens minds suddenly had access to the vast intersubjective realm, which enabled us to create gods and corporations, to build cities and empires, to invent writing and money, and eventually to split the atom and reach the moon. As far as we know, this earth-shattering revolution resulted from a few small changes in the sapiens' DNA and a slight rewiring of the sapiens' brain. If so, says techno-humanism, maybe a few additional changes to our genome and another rewiring of our brain will suffice for launching a second cognitive revolution. The mental renovations of the first cognitive revolution gave Homo sapiens access to the intersubjective realm and turned us into the rulers of the planet. A second cognitive revolution might give Homo Deus access to unimaginable new realms and turn us into the lords of the galaxy. This idea is an updated variant on the old dreams of evolutionary humanism, which already a century ago called for the creation of superhumans. However, whereas Hitler and his ilk planned to create superhumans by means of selective breeding and ethnic cleansing, 21st century techno-humanism hopes to reach the goal far more peacefully with the help of genetic engineering, nanotechnology, and brain-computer interfaces. Gap the mind. Techno-humanism seeks to upgrade the human mind and give us access to unknown experiences and unfamiliar states of consciousness. However, revamping the human mind is an extremely complex and dangerous undertaking. As we heard in Chapter 3, we don't really understand the mind. We don't know how minds emerge or what their function is. Through trial and error, we learn how to engineer mental states, but we seldom comprehend the full implications of such manipulations. Worse yet, since we are unfamiliar with the full spectrum of mental states, we don't know what mental aims to set ourselves. We are akin to the inhabitants of a small isolated island who have just invented the first boat, and are about to set sail without a map or even a destination. Indeed, we are in a somewhat worse condition. The inhabitants of our imaginary island at least know that they occupy just a small space within a large and mysterious sea. We fail to appreciate that we are living on a tiny island of consciousness within a giant ocean of alien mental states. Just as the spectrums of light and sound are far larger than what we humans can see and hear, so the spectrum of mental states is far larger than what the average human is aware of. We can see light in wavelengths of between 400 and 700 nanometers only. Above this small principality of human vision extend the unseen but vast realms of infrared, microwaves, and radio waves, and below it lie the dark kingdoms of ultraviolet, X-rays, and gamma rays. Similarly, the spectrum of possible mental states may be infinite, but science has studied only two tiny sections of it, the subnormative and the weird. For more than a century, psychologists and biologists have conducted extensive research on people suffering from various psychiatric disorders and mental diseases. Consequently, today, we have a very detailed, though far from perfect, map of the subnormative mental spectrum. Simultaneously, scientists have studied the mental states of people considered to be healthy and normative. However, most scientific research about the human mind and the human experience has been conducted on people from Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic, weird, societies, who do not constitute a representative sample of humanity. The study of the human mind has so far assumed that Homo sapiens is Homer Simpson. In a groundbreaking 2010 study, Josef Henrich, Stephen J. Heiner, and Ara Norenzayan systematically surveyed all the papers published between 2003 and 2007 in leading scientific journals belonging to six different subfields of psychology. The study found that though the papers often make broad claims about the human mind, most of them base their findings on exclusively weird samples. For example, in papers published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, arguably the most important journal in the subfield of social psychology, 96% of the sampled individuals were weird, and 68% were Americans. Moreover, 67% of American subjects and 80% of non-American subjects were psychology students. In other words, more than two-thirds of the individuals sampled for papers published in this prestigious journal were psychology students in Western universities. Henrich, Heiner, and Norenzayan half-jokingly suggested that the journal change its name to the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology of American Psychology Students. Psychology students star in many of the studies because their professors oblige them to take part in experiments. If I am a psychology professor at Harvard, it is much easier for me to conduct experiments on my own students than on the residents of a crime-ridden New York slum, not to mention traveling to Namibia and conducting experiments on hunter-gatherers in the Kalahari Desert. However, it may well be that New York slum dwellers and Kalahari hunter-gatherers experience mental states which we will never discover by forcing Harvard psychology students to answer long questionnaires or stick their heads into fMRI scanners. Even if we travel all over the globe and study each and every community, we would still cover only a limited part of the sapiens' mental spectrum. Nowadays, all humans have been touched by modernity, and we are all members of a single global village. Though Kalahari foragers are somewhat less modern than Harvard psychology students, they are not a time capsule from our distant past. They too have been influenced by Christian missionaries, European traders, wealthy ecotourists, and inquisitive anthropologists. The joke is that in the Kalahari Desert, the typical hunter-gatherer band consists of 20 hunters, 20 gatherers, and 50 anthropologists. Before the emergence of the global village, the planet was a galaxy of isolated human cultures, which might have fostered mental states that are now extinct. Different socio-economic realities and daily routines nurtured different states of consciousness. Who could gauge the minds of Stone Age mammoth hunters Neolithic farmers or Kamakura samurais. Moreover, many pre-modern cultures believed in the existence of superior states of consciousness, which people might access using meditation, drugs, or rituals. Shamans, monks, and ascetics systematically explored the mysterious lands of mind, and came back laden with breathtaking stories. They told of unfamiliar states of supreme tranquility, extreme sharpness, and matchless sensitivity. They told of the mind expanding to infinity, or dissolving into emptiness. The humanist revolution caused modern Western culture to lose faith and interest in superior mental states, and to sanctify the mundane experiences of the average Joe. Modern Western culture is therefore unique in lacking a special class of people who seek to experience extraordinary mental states. It believes anyone attempting to do so is a drug addict, mental patient, or charlatan. Consequently, though we have a detailed map of the mental landscape of Harvard psychology students, we know far less about the mental landscapes of Native American shamans, Buddhist monks, or Sufi mystics. And that is just the sapiens mind. 50,000 years ago, we shared this planet with our Neanderthal cousins. They didn't launch spaceships, build pyramids, or establish empires. They obviously had very different mental abilities, and lacked many of our talents. Nevertheless, they had bigger brains than us sapiens. What exactly did they do with all those neurons? We have absolutely no idea. But they might well have had many mental states that no sapiens had ever experienced. Yet even if we take into account all human species that ever existed, that would still not exhaust the mental spectrum. Other animals probably have experiences that we humans can barely imagine. Bats, for example, experience the world through echolocation. They emit a very rapid stream of high-frequency calls, well beyond the range of the human ear. They then detect and interpret the returning echoes to build a picture of the world. That picture is so detailed and accurate that the bats can fly quickly between trees and buildings, chase and capture moths and mosquitoes, and all the time evade owls and other predators. The bats live in a world of echoes. Just as in the human world every object has a characteristic shape and color, so in the bat world every object has its echo pattern. A bat can tell the difference between a tasty moth species and a poisonous moth species by the different echoes returning from their slender wings. Some edible moth species try to protect themselves by evolving an echo pattern similar to that of a poisonous species. Other moths have evolved an even more remarkable ability to deflect the waves of the bat radar, so that, like stealth bombers, they fly around without the bat knowing they are there. The world of echolocation is as complex and stormy as our familiar world of sound and sight, but we are completely oblivious to it. One of the most important articles about the philosophy of mind is titled, "What Is It Like to Be a Bat?" In this 1974 article, the philosopher Thomas Nagel points out that a sapien's mind cannot fathom the subjective world of a bat. We can write all the algorithms we want about the bat body, about bat echolocation systems, and about bat neurons, but it won't tell us how it feels to be a bat. How does it feel to echolocate a moth flapping its wings? Is it similar to seeing it? Or is it something completely different? Trying to explain to a sapiens how it feels to echolocate a butterfly is probably as pointless as explaining to a blind mole how it feels to see a Caravaggio. It's likely that bat emotions are also deeply influenced by the centrality of their echolocation sense. For sapiens, love is red, envy is green, and depression is blue. Who knows what echolocations color the love of a female bat to her offspring, or the feelings of a male bat towards his rivals? Bats aren't special, of course. They are but one out of countless possible examples. Just as sapiens cannot understand what it's like to be a bat, we have similar difficulties understanding how it feels to be a whale, a tiger, or a pelican. It certainly feels like something, but we don't know like what. Both whales and humans process emotions in a part of the brain called the limbic system. Yet the whale limbic system contains an entire additional part which is missing from the human structure. Maybe that part enables whales to experience extremely deep and complex emotions which are alien to us. Whales might also have astounding musical experiences which even Bach and Mozart couldn't grasp. Whales can hear one another from hundreds of kilometers away, and each whale has a repertoire of characteristic songs that may last for hours and follow very intricate patterns. Every now and then a whale composes a new hit, which other whales throughout the ocean adopt. Scientists routinely record these hits and analyze them with the help of computers. But can any human fathom these musical experiences and tell the difference between a whale Beethoven and a whale Justin Bieber? None of this should surprise us. Sapiens don't rule the world because they have deeper emotions or more complex musical experiences than other animals. So we may be inferior to whales, bats, tigers, and pelicans, at least in some emotional and experiential domains. Beyond the mental spectrum of humans, bats, whales, and all other animals, even vaster and stranger continents may lie in wait. In all probability, there is an infinite variety of mental states that no sapiens, bat, or dinosaur ever experienced in 4 billion years of terrestrial evolution because they did not have the necessary faculties. In the future, however, powerful drugs, genetic engineering, electronic helmets, and direct brain-computer interfaces may open passages to these places. Just as Columbus and Magellan sailed beyond the horizon to explore new islands and unknown continents, so we may one day set sail towards the antipodes of the mind. I smell fear. As long as doctors, engineers, and customers focused on healing mental diseases and enjoying life in weird societies, the study of subnormal mental states and weird minds was perhaps sufficient to our needs. Though normative psychology is often accused of mistreating any divergence from the norm, in the last century it has brought relief to countless people, saving the lives and sanity of millions. However, at the beginning of the third millennium, we face a completely different kind of challenge, as liberal humanism makes way for techno-humanism, and medicine is increasingly focused on upgrading the healthy rather than healing the sick. Doctors, engineers, and customers no longer want merely to fix mental problems. They seek to upgrade the mind. We are acquiring the technical abilities to begin manufacturing new states of consciousness, yet we lack a map of these potential new territories. Since we are familiar mainly with the normative and subnormative mental spectrum of weird people, we don't even know what destinations to aim towards. Not surprisingly, then, positive psychology has become the trendiest subfield of the discipline. In the 1990s, leading experts such as Martin Seligman, Ed Dinner, and Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi argued that psychology should study not just mental illnesses, but also mental strengths. How come we have a remarkably detailed atlas of the sick mind, but have no scientific map of the prosperous mind? Over the last 2 decades, positive psychology has made important first steps in the study of supernormative mental states, but as of 2016, the supernormative zone is largely terra incognito to science. Under such circumstances, we might rush forward without any map and focus on upgrading those mental abilities that the current economic and political system needs, while neglecting and even downgrading other abilities. Of course, this is not a completely new phenomenon. For thousands of years, the system has been shaping and reshaping our minds according to its needs. Sapiens originally evolved as members of small, intimate communities, and their mental faculties were not adapted to living as cogs within a giant machine. However, with the rise of cities, kingdoms, and empires, the system cultivated capacities required for large-scale cooperation, while disregarding other skills and talents. For example, archaic humans probably made extensive use of their sense of smell. Hunter-gatherers are able to smell from a distance the difference between various animal species, various humans, and even various emotions. Fear, for example, smells different to courage. When a man is afraid, he secretes different chemicals compared to when he is full of courage. If you sat among an archaic band debating whether to start a war against a neighboring band, you could literally smell public opinion. As sapiens organize themselves in larger groups, our nose lost its importance, because it is useful only when dealing with small numbers of individuals. You cannot, for example, smell the American fear of China. Consequently, human olfactory powers were neglected. Brain areas that tens of thousands of years ago probably dealt with odors were put to work on more urgent tasks, such as reading, mathematics, and abstract reasoning. The system prefers that our neurons solve differential equations rather than smell our neighbors. The same thing happened to our other senses, and to the underlying ability to pay attention to our sensations. Ancient foragers were always sharp and attentive. Wandering in the forest in search of mushrooms, they sniffed the wind carefully and watched the ground intently. When they found a mushroom, they ate it with the utmost attention, aware of every little nuance of flavor, which could distinguish an edible mushroom from its poisonous cousin. Members of today's affluent societies don't need such keen awareness. We can go to the supermarket and buy any of 1,000 different dishes, all supervised by the health authorities. But whatever we choose, Italian pizza or Thai noodles, we are likely to eat it in haste in front of the TV, hardly paying attention to the taste, which is why food producers are constantly inventing new, exciting flavors, which might somehow pierce the curtain of indifference. Similarly, when going on holiday, we can choose between thousands of amazing destinations. But wherever we go, we are likely to be playing with our smartphone instead of really seeing the place. We have more choice than ever before, but no matter what we choose, we have lost the ability to really pay attention to it. In addition to smelling and paying attention, we have also been losing our ability to dream. Many cultures believed that what people see and do in their dreams is no less important than what they see and do while awake. Hence, people actively developed their ability to dream, to remember dreams, and even to control their actions in the dream world, which is known as lucid dreaming. Experts in lucid dreaming could move about the dream world at will, and claimed they could even travel to higher planes of existence, or meet visitors from other worlds. The modern world, in contrast, dismisses dreams as subconscious messages at best, and mental garbage at worst. Consequently, dreams play a much smaller part in our lives. Few people actively develop their dreaming skills, and many people claim that they don't dream at all, or that they cannot remember any of their dreams. Did the decline in our capacity to smell, to pay attention, and to dream make our lives poorer and grayer? Maybe. But even if it did, for the economic and political system, it was worth it. Mathematical skills are more important to the economy than smelling flowers or dreaming about fairies. For similar reasons, it is likely that future upgrades to the human mind will reflect political needs and market forces. For example, the US Army's attention helmet is meant to help people focus on well-defined tasks and speed up their decision-making process. It may, however, reduce their ability to show empathy and tolerate doubts and inner conflict. Humanist psychologists have pointed out that people in distress often don't want a quick fix. They want somebody to listen to them and sympathize with their fears and misgivings. Suppose you are having an ongoing crisis in your workplace because your new boss doesn't appreciate your views and insists on doing everything her way. After one particularly unhappy day, you pick up the phone and call a friend. But the friend has little time and energy for you, so he cuts you short and tries to solve your problem. Okay, I get it. Well, you really have just two options here. Either quit the job or stay and do what the boss wants. And if I were you, I would quit. That would hardly help. A really good friend will have patience and will not be quick to find a solution. He will listen to your distress and will provide time and space for all your contradictory emotions and gnawing anxieties to surface. The attention helmet works a bit like the impatient friend. Of course, sometimes, on the battlefield, for instance, people need to take firm decisions quickly. But there is more to life than that. If we start using the attention helmet in more and more situations, we may end up losing our ability to tolerate confusion, doubts, and contradictions, just as we have lost our ability to smell, dream, and pay attention. The system may push us in that direction, because it usually rewards us for the decisions we make rather than for our doubts. Yet a life of resolute decisions and quick fixes may be poorer and shallower than one of doubts and contradictions. When you mix a practical ability to engineer minds with our ignorance of the mental spectrum, and with the narrow interests of governments, armies, and corporations, you get a recipe for trouble. We may successfully upgrade our bodies and our brains, while losing our minds in the process. Indeed, techno-humanism may end up downgrading humans. The system may prefer downgraded humans, not because they would possess any superhuman knacks, but because they would lack some really disturbing human qualities that hamper the system and slow it down. As any farmer knows, it's usually the brightest goat in the herd that stirs up the greatest trouble, which is why the agricultural revolution involved downgrading animal mental abilities. The second cognitive revolution dreamed up by techno-humanists might do the same to us. The nail on which the universe hangs. Techno-humanism faces another dire threat. Like all humanist sects, techno-humanism too sanctifies the human will, seeing it as the nail on which the entire universe hangs. Techno-humanism expects our desires to choose which mental abilities to develop, and to thereby determine the shape of future minds. Yet what would happen once technological progress makes it possible to reshape and engineer our desires themselves? Humanism always emphasized that it is not easy to identify our authentic will. When we try to listen to ourselves, we are often flooded by a cacophony of conflicting noises. Indeed, we sometimes don't really want to hear our authentic voice, because it can disclose unwelcome secrets and make uncomfortable requests. Many people take great care not to probe themselves too deeply. A successful lawyer on the fast track may stifle an inner voice telling her to take a break and have a child. A woman trapped in a dissatisfying marriage fears losing the security it provides. A guilt-ridden soldier is stalked by nightmares about atrocities he committed. A young man unsure of his sexuality follows a personal "don't ask, don't tell" policy. Humanism doesn't think any of these situations has an obvious one-size-fits-all solution. But humanism demands that we show some guts, listen to the inner messages even if they scare us, identify our authentic voice, and then follow its instructions regardless of the difficulties. Technological progress has a very different agenda. It doesn't want to listen to our inner voices. It wants to control them. Once we understand the biochemical system producing all these voices, we can play with the switches, turn up the volume here, lower it there, and make life much more easy and comfortable. We'll give Ritalin to the distracted lawyer, Prozac to the guilty soldier, and Cipralex to the dissatisfied wife. And that's just the beginning. Humanists are often appalled by this approach, but we had better not pass judgment on it too quickly. The humanist recommendation to listen to ourselves has ruined the lives of many a person, whereas the right dosage of the right chemical has greatly improved the well-being and relationships of millions. In order to really listen to themselves, some people must first turn down the volume of the inner screams and diatribes. According to modern psychiatry, many inner voices and authentic wishes are nothing more than the product of biochemical imbalances and neurological diseases. People suffering from clinical depression repeatedly walk out on promising careers and healthy relationships because some biochemical glitch makes them see everything through dark-colored lenses. Instead of listening to such destructive inner voices, it might be a good idea to shut them up. When Sally Ady used the attention helmet to silence the voices in her head, she not only became an expert markswoman, but she also felt much better about herself. Personally, you may have many different views about these issues. Yet, from a historical perspective, it is clear that something momentous is happening. The number one humanist commandment, listen to yourself, is no longer self-evident. As we learn to turn our inner volume up and down, we give up our belief in authenticity, because it is no longer clear whose hand is on the switch. Silencing annoying noises inside your head seems like a wonderful idea, provided it enables you to finally hear your deep, authentic self. But if there is no authentic self, how do you decide which voices to silence and which to amplify? Let's assume, just for the sake of argument, that within a few decades, brain scientists will give us easy and accurate control over many inner voices. Imagine a young gay man from a devout Mormon family who, after years of living in the closet, has finally accumulated enough money to finance a passion operation. He goes to the clinic armed with $100,000, determined to walk out of it as straight as Joseph Smith. Standing in front of the clinic's door, he mentally repeats what he is going to say to the doctor. "Doc, here's $100,000. Please fix me so that I will never want men again." He then rings the bell and the door is opened by a real-life George Clooney. "Doc," mumbles the overwhelmed lad, "here's $100,000. Please fix me so that I will never want to be straight again." Did the young man's authentic self win over the religious brainwashing he underwent? Or perhaps a moment's temptation caused him to betray himself? And perhaps there is simply no such thing as an authentic self that you can follow or betray. Once people could design and redesign their will, we could no longer see it as the ultimate source of all meaning and authority. For no matter what our will says, we can always make it say something else. According to humanism, only human desires imbue the world with meaning. Yet, if we could choose our desires, on what basis could we possibly make such choices? Suppose Romeo and Juliet opened with Romeo having to decide with whom to fall in love. And suppose, even after making a decision, Romeo could always retract and make a different choice instead. What kind of play would it have been? Well, that's the play technological progress is trying to produce for us. When our desires make us uncomfortable, technology promises to bail us out. When the nail on which the entire universe hangs is pegged in a problematic spot, technology would pull it out and stick it somewhere else. But where, exactly? If I could peg that nail anywhere in the cosmos, where should I peg it? And why there, of all places? Humanist dramas unfold when people have uncomfortable desires. For example, it is extremely uncomfortable when Romeo, of the House of Montague, falls in love with Juliet, of the House of Capulet, because the Montagues and Capulets are bitter enemies. The technological solution to such dramas is to make sure we never have uncomfortable desires. How much pain and sorrow would have been avoided if, instead of drinking poison, Romeo and Juliet could just take a pill or wear a helmet that would have redirected their star-crossed love towards other people? Techno-humanism faces an impossible dilemma here. It considers the human will to be the most important thing in the universe, hence it pushes humankind to develop technologies that can control and redesign our will. After all, it's tempting to gain control over the most important thing in the world. Yet, once we have such control, techno-humanism would not know what to do with it, because the sacred human will would become just another designer product. We can never deal with such technologies as long as we believe that the human will and the human experience are the supreme source of authority and meaning. Hence, a bolder techno-religion seeks to sever the humanist umbilical cord altogether. It foresees a world which does not revolve around the desires and experiences of any human-like beings. What might replace desires and experiences as the source of all meaning and authority? As of 2016, only one candidate is sitting in history's reception room, waiting for the job interview. This candidate is information. The most interesting emerging religion is dataism, which venerates neither gods nor man. It worships data. Chapter 11. The Data Religion. Dataism says that the universe consists of data flows, and the value of any phenomenon or entity is determined by its contribution to data processing. This may strike you as some eccentric fringe notion, but in fact it has already conquered most of the scientific establishment. Dataism was born from the explosive confluence of two scientific tidal waves. In the 150 years since Charles Darwin published On the Origin of Species, the life sciences have come to see organisms as biochemical algorithms. Simultaneously, in the 8 decades since Alan Turing formulated the idea of a Turing machine, computer scientists have learned to engineer increasingly sophisticated electronic algorithms. Dataism puts the two together, pointing out that exactly the same mathematical laws apply to both biochemical and electronic algorithms. Dataism thereby collapses the barrier between animals and machines, and expects electronic algorithms to eventually decipher and outperform biochemical algorithms. For politicians, business people, and ordinary consumers, dataism offers groundbreaking technologies and immense new powers. For scholars and intellectuals, it also promises to provide the scientific holy grail that has eluded us for centuries, a single overarching theory that unifies all the scientific disciplines, from literature and musicology to economics and biology. According to dataism, King Lear and the flu virus are just two patterns of data flow that can be analyzed using the same basic concepts and tools. This idea is extremely attractive. It gives all scientists a common language, builds bridges over academic rifts, and easily exports insights across disciplinary borders. Musicologists, political scientists, and cell biologists can finally understand each other. In the process, dataism inverts the traditional pyramid of learning. Hitherto, data was seen as only the first step in a long chain of intellectual activity. Humans were supposed to distill data into information, information into knowledge, and knowledge into wisdom. However, dataists believe that humans can no longer cope with the immense flows of data, hence they cannot distill data into information, let alone into knowledge or wisdom. The work of processing data should therefore be entrusted to electronic algorithms, whose capacity far exceeds that of the human brain. In practice, this means that dataists are skeptical about human knowledge and wisdom, and prefer to put their trust in big data and computer algorithms. Dataism is most firmly entrenched in its two mother disciplines, computer science and biology. Of the two, biology is the more important. It was the biological embracement of dataism that turned a limited breakthrough in computer science into a world-shattering cataclysm that may completely transform the very nature of life. You may not agree with the idea that organisms are algorithms, and that giraffes, tomatoes, and human beings are just different methods for processing data, but you should know that this is current scientific dogma, and that it is changing our world beyond recognition. Not only individual organisms are seen today as data processing systems, but also entire societies, such as beehives, bacteria colonies, forests, and human cities. Economists increasingly interpret the economy, too, as a data processing system. Laypeople believe that the economy consists of peasants growing wheat, workers manufacturing clothes, and customers buying bread and underpants. Yet experts see the economy as a mechanism for gathering data about desires and abilities, and turning this data into decisions. According to this view, free market capitalism and state-controlled communism aren't competing ideologies, ethical creeds, or political institutions. At bottom, they are competing data processing systems. Capitalism uses distributed processing, whereas communism relies on centralized processing. Capitalism processes data by directly connecting all producers and consumers to one another, and allowing them to exchange information freely and make decisions independently. For example, how do you determine the price of bread in a free market? Well, every bakery may produce as much bread as it likes, and charge for it as much as it wants. The customers are equally free to buy as much bread as they can afford, or take their business to the competitor. It isn't illegal to charge $1,000 for a baguette, but nobody is likely to buy it. On a much grander scale, if investors predict increased demand for bread, they will buy shares of biotech firms that genetically engineer more prolific wheat strains. The inflow of capital will enable the firms to speed up their research, thereby providing more wheat faster and averting bread shortages. Even if one biotech giant adopts a flawed theory and reaches an impasse, its more successful competitors will achieve the hoped-for breakthrough. Free market capitalism thus distributes the work of analyzing data and making decisions between many independent but interconnected processes. As the Austrian economics guru Friedrich Hayek explained, in a system in which the knowledge of the relevant facts is dispersed among many people, prices can act to coordinate the separate actions of different people. According to this view, the stock exchange is the fastest and most efficient data processing system humankind has so far created. Everyone is welcome to join, if not directly, then through their banks or pension funds. The stock exchange runs the global economy and takes into account everything that happens all over the planet, and even beyond it. Prices are influenced by successful scientific experiments, by political scandals in Japan, by volcanic eruptions in Iceland, and even by irregular activities on the surface of the sun. In order for the system to run smoothly, as much information as possible needs to flow as freely as possible. When millions of people throughout the world have access to all the relevant information, they determine the most accurate price of oil, of Hyundai shares, and of Swedish government bonds by buying and selling them. It has been estimated that the stock exchange needs just 15 minutes of trade to determine the influence of a New York Times headline on the prices of most shares. Data processing considerations also explain why capitalists favor lower taxes. Heavy taxation means that a large part of all available capital accumulates in one place, the state coffers, and consequently more and more decisions have to be made by a single processor, namely the government. This creates an overly centralized data processing system. In extreme cases, when taxes are exceedingly high, almost all capital ends up in the government's hands, and so the government alone calls the shots. It dictates the price of bread, the location of bakeries, and the research and development budget. In a free market, if one processor makes a wrong decision, others will be quick to utilize its mistake. However, when a single processor makes almost all the decisions, mistakes can be catastrophic. This extreme situation in which all data is processed and all decisions are made by a single central processor is called communism. In a communist economy, people allegedly work according to their abilities and receive according to their needs. In other words, the government takes 100% of your profits, decides what you need, and then supplies these needs. Though no country ever realized this scheme in its extreme form, the Soviet Union and its satellites came as close as they could. They abandoned the principle of distributed data processing and switched to a model of centralized data processing. All information from throughout the Soviet Union flowed to a single location in Moscow, where all the important decisions were made. Producers and consumers could not communicate directly, and had to obey government orders. For instance, the Soviet Economics Ministry might decide that the price of bread in all shops should be exactly 2 rubles and 4 kopecks, that a particular kolkhoz in the Odessa oblast should switch from growing wheat to raising chickens, and that the Red October bakery in Moscow should produce 3.5 million loaves of bread per day, and not a single loaf more. Meanwhile, the Soviet Science Ministry forced all Soviet biotech laboratories to adopt the theories of Trofim Lysenko, the infamous head of the Lenin Academy for Agricultural Sciences. Lysenko rejected the dominant genetic theories of his day. He insisted that if an organism acquired some new trait during its lifetime, this quality could pass directly to its descendants. This idea flew in the face of Darwinian orthodoxy, but it dovetailed nicely with communist educational principles. It implied that if you could train wheat plants to withstand cold weather, their progenies will also be cold-resistant. Lysenko accordingly sent billions of counter-revolutionary wheat plants to be re-educated in Siberia, and the Soviet Union was soon forced to import more and more flour from the United States. Capitalism did not defeat communism because capitalism was more ethical, because individual liberties are sacred, or because God was angry with the heathen communists. Rather, capitalism won the Cold War because distributed data processing works better than centralized data processing, at least in periods of accelerating technological changes. The Central Committee of the Communist Party just could not deal with the rapidly changing world of the late 20th century. When all data is accumulated in one secret bunker, and all important decisions are taken by a group of elderly apparatchiks, you can produce nuclear bombs by the cartload, but you won't get an Apple or a Wikipedia. There is a story, probably apocryphal, like most good stories, that when Mikhail Gorbachev tried to resuscitate the moribund Soviet economy, he sent one of his chief aides to London to find out what Thatcherism was all about and how a capitalist system actually functioned. The hosts took their Soviet visitor on a tour of the city, of the London Stock Exchange, and of the London School of Economics, where he had lengthy talks with bank managers, entrepreneurs, and professors. After a few hours, the Soviet expert burst out, "Just one moment, please. Forget about all these complicated economic theories. We have been going back and forth across London for a whole day now, and there's one thing I cannot understand. Back in Moscow, our finest minds are working on the bread supply system, and yet there are such long queues in every bakery and grocery store. Here in London live millions of people, and we have passed today in front of many shops and supermarkets, yet I haven't seen a single bread queue. Please take me to meet the person in charge of supplying bread to London. I must learn his secret." The hosts scratched their heads, thought for a moment, and said, "Nobody is in charge of supplying bread to London." That's the capitalist secret of success. No central processing unit monopolizes all the data on the London bread supply. The information flows freely between millions of consumers and producers, bakers and tycoons, farmers and scientists. Market forces determine the price of bread, the number of loaves baked each day, and the research and development priorities. If market forces make the wrong decision, they soon correct themselves, or so capitalists believe. For our current purposes, it doesn't matter whether the theory is correct. The crucial thing is that the theory understands economics in terms of data processing. Where has all the power gone? Political scientists also increasingly interpret human political structures as data processing systems. Like capitalism and communism, so democracies and dictatorships are in essence competing mechanisms for gathering and analyzing information. Dictatorships use centralized processing methods, whereas democracies prefer distributed processing. In the last decades, democracy gained the upper hand because under the unique conditions of the late 20th century, distributed processing worked better. Under alternative conditions, those prevailing in the ancient Roman Empire, for instance, centralized processing had an edge, which is why the Roman Republic fell and power shifted from the Senate and popular assemblies into the hands of a single autocratic emperor. This implies that as data processing conditions change again in the 21st century, democracy might decline and even disappear. As both the volume and speed of data increase, venerable institutions like elections, parties, and parliaments might become obsolete, not because they are unethical, but because they don't process data efficiently enough. These institutions evolved in an era when politics moved faster than technology. In the 19th and 20th centuries, the Industrial Revolution unfolded slowly enough for politicians and voters to remain one step ahead of it and regulate and manipulate its course. Yet, whereas the rhythm of politics has not changed much since the days of steam, technology has switched from first gear to fourth. Technological revolutions now outpace political processes, causing MPs and voters alike to lose control. The rise of the Internet gives us a taste of things to come. Cyberspace is now crucial to our daily lives, our economy, and our security. Yet the critical choices between alternative web designs weren't taken through a democratic political process, even though they involved traditional political issues such as sovereignty, borders, privacy, and security. Did you ever vote about the shape of cyberspace? Decisions made by web designers far from the public limelight mean that today the Internet is a free and lawless zone that erodes state sovereignty, ignores borders, abolishes privacy, and poses perhaps the most formidable global security risk. Whereas a decade ago it hardly registered on the radar, today hysterical officials are predicting an imminent cyber 9/11. Governments and NGOs consequently conduct intense debates about restructuring the Internet, but it is much harder to change an existing system than to intervene at its inception. Besides, by the time the cumbersome government bureaucracy makes up its mind about cyber regulation, the Internet has morphed 10 times. The governmental tortoise cannot keep up with the technological hare. It is overwhelmed by data. The NSA may be spying on your every word, but to judge by the repeated failure of American foreign policy, nobody in Washington knows what to do with all the data. Never in history did a government know so much about what's going on in the world, yet few empires have botched things up as clumsily as the contemporary United States. It's like a poker player who knows what cards his opponents hold, yet somehow still manages to lose round after round. In the coming decades, it is likely that we will see more Internet-like revolutions, in which technology steals a march on politics. Artificial intelligence and biotechnology might soon overhaul our societies and economies, and our bodies and minds too, but they are hardly a blip on our political radar. Our current democratic structures just cannot collect and process the relevant data fast enough, and most voters don't understand biology and cybernetics well enough to form any pertinent opinions. Hence, traditional democratic politics loses control of events and fails to provide us with meaningful visions for the future. That doesn't mean we will go back to 20th-century-style dictatorships. Authoritarian regimes seem to be equally overwhelmed by the pace of technological development and the speed and volume of the data flow. In the 20th century, dictators had grand visions for the future. Communists and fascists alike sought to completely destroy the old world and build a new world in its place. Whatever you think about Lenin, Hitler, or Mao, you cannot accuse them of lacking vision. Today it seems that leaders have a chance to pursue even grander visions. While communists and Nazis tried to create a new society and a new human with the help of steam engines and typewriters, today's prophets could rely on biotechnology and supercomputers. In science fiction films, ruthless Hitler-like politicians are quick to pounce on such new technologies, putting them in the service of this or that megalomaniac political ideal. Yet flesh-and-blood politicians in the early 21st century, even in authoritarian countries such as Russia, Iran, or North Korea, are nothing like their Hollywood counterparts. They don't seem to plot any brave new world. The wildest dreams of Kim Jong-un and Ali Khamenei don't go much beyond atom bombs and ballistic missiles. That is so 1945. Putin's aspirations seem confined to rebuilding the old Soviet zone, or the even older Tsarist Empire. Meanwhile, in the USA, paranoid Republicans accuse Barack Obama of being a ruthless despot, hatching conspiracies to destroy the foundations of American society. Yet, in 8 years of presidency, he barely managed to pass a minor healthcare reform.